It's almost time for kids to head back to school, and for some, that can mean a radical shift in sleep schedules. This is Talk of Iowa. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. With us today is Dr. Eric Dykin, a neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorders Clinic at the University of Iowa. A lot of teenagers spend their summers sleeping late into the day. When school starts, many struggle not only with getting to school on time and staying alert, but the pressure of before school activities as well. Today we'll talk about the sleep needs of teenagers and how to transition into the school year. We'll also talk about new research into the chronic sleepiness that can result from traumatic brain injuries. And we'll take your sleep-related questions. The number to call is 866-780-9100. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Dr. Eric Dykin, a neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorders Clinic at the University of Iowa. A lot of teenagers spend their summers sleeping late into the day. When school starts, they have to make a radical shift to getting up early, and some of them have been known to struggle in the past. Today, we'll talk about the sleep needs of teenagers. We'll also talk about new research into the chronic sleepiness that can result from traumatic brain injuries, and we'll take your sleep-related questions. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Good morning, Dr. Dykin.
Morning.
Thank you so much for coming in today.
Happy to be here.
So teenagers do have this natural tendency to stay up late and sleep late as they shift into trying to meet the school schedule. What are some of the problems that they can encounter?
Well, teenagers, young adults, are relatively phase delayed. That's the official term compared to middle age and older adults. They tend to naturally sleep go to bed later at night and then sleep later in the morning so they can get their 7 to 9 hours of total sleep that grandma said you need. And so they're genetically and developmentally made to do that. I mean, that's normal for them. Nevertheless, society makes the school time, starting time, much earlier than is physiologically normal for them. And as such, they have real difficulties getting to school compared to us middle-aged adults who make all the decisions. So it's really set up so that you can go to work, get your kids off to school, and not have to worry about a babysitter until their normal time for school should have started. So it's sort of a societal thing that they've – and they've done some experiments on that. Dr. Mahawald and Rosalind – and was it Dr. Mahawald and I'll think of who else is doing this work. But in Minnesota and in Kentucky, they actually had some experiments with local schools where they had allowed the children to sleep later like they normally should be and then sleep in later in the morning. And they did a lot better on their schoolwork, and there was a lot less of fatalities in regard to teenage motor vehicle accidents. Now, I mean, those may be just associates. That may have been serendipity. But there is some evidence that you do need good, solid 7 to 9 hours of sleep. And if you throw somebody into the wrong time frame, it can affect their learning.
When does that start to switch? I have small children in my house, and they certainly are early risers. And they go to bed early, and that seems to work out great. When does the shift start where kids just naturally stay up later and get up later?
Well, you know, it's sort of – you sort of slide into it. You could be married to somebody who's developed a thyroid problem and you don't notice it, and then 5 years later you meet old classmates. They go, boy, your husband sure has gained some weight and he's all puffy around his eye. And you go, I haven't noticed that, because you sort of slide into it. It's the same thing that kids will slide into from the moment they're born. And when they're born, they're ultradian. They'll have a full sleep cycle, waking cycle, just within a 4 or 5 hour period. But all of a sudden, over a 1 year period, they start sleeping throughout the night, and you may or may not notice that. Then all of a sudden, as they reach the early years to puberty years, they start staying up later. And you wonder if they're seeing bad friends. And then they sleep in later. You can't wake them up. And you wonder if they're on drugs. And then they grow up and they have their own kids. And you wonder why they're not having the problems that they used to have. And they're complaining of their kids having. And it's a Piagetian kind of thing. And as we get really older, over the age of 50, 60, 70, I don't watch really older anymore. That's becoming relatively young for me. But we tend to go to bed earlier. and wake up earlier. We phase advance. And it's all based on the development, the aging of your biologic clock. And we call that the suprachiasmatic nucleus. It's in the hypothalamus of the brain. And when it ages, it does funny things. And when it's young, it does funny things. And it's just sort of a gradual gradation. And everybody's a variable unto themselves. Because I know there are people out there saying, well, my kids don't do that. And you could probably get by with waking up earlier, as they do and have done for years. But you might make them even better, smarter, and more alert if you allowed them to follow their own natural 24-hour or circadian sleep-wake rhythms.
Now, a lot of parents get frustrated with their kids who want to stay up late every night, which is what their bodies are telling them to do. What can you do to – I mean, we can accept them, but what can you do to actually help your kids get enough sleep?
Well, there is that thought, and Mark Mahalwald has taken it to the some people might say extreme, but probably to the righteous extreme. Maybe it's better to change the school times. Boy, that would be expensive, and it'd be really tough for me because I drop my kids off when I go to work.
Right.
So you think about that. But if you're fighting Mother Nature, it's very difficult to win. And I think what you have to realize is it is normal for teenagers, young adults, to want to stay up later because of their circadian rhythms. And it's normal for them to want to get 7 to 9 hours of sleep, so they tend to sleep in. So you can try to help adjust by having good habits, a good routine, 7 nights a week with a routine bedtime and awakening time. But try to do that with your teenagers on the weekend. Try to do that with a young adult who has parties and friends and obligations, or maybe even a second job here at college, fraternity, sorority obligations. It's really difficult to adjust that. One of the things that parents can do for their kids, though, is maybe make sure that they're not texting all night. That is a new phenomena, on the computer all night. I know my son and my daughter, you get hypnotized. That is one element of poor sleep hygiene that my son will often use as an excuse. Well, I'm studying, I'm on texting or whatever. But we look at that light. He's been up later than he used to be. And I think it's because he's got the door locked and he's texting and he's playing the computer. I have no question about it. So you would like to adjust, maybe limit the use of your computerized entertainment elements so that the kids aren't just having poor sleep hygiene but are following more of their natural rhythms. And then you can lobby for changing the bedtimes. I mean, boy, would that be dramatic. But maybe that's the right thing. Maybe that's the wrong thing.
We would love to hear what your concerns and questions are. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I wanted to talk a little bit about some new research that you are doing into the sleepiness that can result from traumatic brain injuries. How common is that with a brain injury?
Well, pretty common. And, you know, especially in our contact sports, we've got the football players routinely running in, you know, butting heads. My daughter's on the national taekwondo team here at the university. They've got a increased points, 3 points in national competition for kicking someone in the head. And if they fall down, you get another 1 or 2 points. But that's martial arts. They do get hit in the head. Softball players get hit in the head. Runners can fall. One of our cross-country runners at Regina High School, just the greatest runner in the world, he fell at the beginning of the state qualifiers and was knocked out, got up, and continued to run. And for the next 1 to 2 weeks, he was nauseated, couldn't run a few steps without vomiting. So when you take the head and you shake it all around, that sleep center that we talked about, it can really get messed up. You can damage it on a microscopic level. So the injury to some of the cells that keep us either awake or that keep us sleepy, it can be either insomnia or sleepiness, and it's not unusual to hear about. And it's amazing to many of us physicians because we get an MRI of the brain, the big X-ray, and you don't see any abnormality, because it's more on a microscopic level. But if you have one concussion or bad head injury, shake your head around a little bit, and then all of a sudden you're back to normal, then a second and a third and a fourth, you can have the same problem you see with Muhammad Ali. That's dementia pugilistica or Parkinsonism pugilistica, where you've been hit so many times as you naturally age and drop out those cells, it becomes unmasked, and you can have problems with thinking, sleeping, breathing, eating, walking, moving. So being hit in the head is a great big bad thing to do, and you can be left with subtle abnormalities. And that's what our study is about. People with mild to moderate head injury, they may have a perfectly normal x-ray of the brain that the doctors say, I don't know, you've been different ever since then. Is this a litigious thing? Are you going to sue somebody? Are you putting on a show? Because your x-ray, your pictures look normal, but they may not be. And it's where we often do these neurocognitive subtle tests to see how the brain is functioning, and that can often be disclosed very easily. And then the rest of it is believable, that I just can't sleep well, or I'm just too sleepy, either way.
Well, a lot of people who get hit in the head, of course, their big concern is hemorrhage and that kind of thing. So once they rule out the major problems, they probably just try to get on with their lives. So what do people report to you about noticing small changes?
Well, I like the way you said that, because as you said, major changes. If it's on an x-ray, then we can see it. It must be a major change. But people with subtle, mild to moderate head injury, their disadvantage is they don't have a picture to show up to say, a major change. What if you couldn't sleep? You know, that was used at Guantanamo Bay as torture.
Right.
What if you can't get to sleep? Your x-ray looks normal and no one's listening to you because your x-ray looks normal. And it can be devastating. You know, if you're sleepy all the time, you're trying to work in the radio and you fall asleep, well, you would probably lose your job. Same thing with me or my surgeon friends. Falling asleep on the job, depending on what you're doing, like a truck driver. Our truck drivers are the safest in the world because – we've studied that. If they fall asleep, 4.2 people go to the grave with him. And so if you've had a mild head injury to moderate head injury and your profession is a truck driver and you keep falling asleep at work, that's a bad thing. Same thing with radio announcing, being a medical doctor, a car mechanic, working at the cashier registry at Hy-Vee. You can't function. And my thought is, then you can't feed your kids. Then my thought is, you may not be able to raise your kids. And tell me that's not a major
right.
problem. But I like the way you said it, major problem.
Well, right now you're in the studying process. So what are you doing right now?
Well, there's a new medication that has been on the market that we use to treat people with a genetic problem called narcolepsy. They fall asleep all the time. They can't work. That medicine mimics what they may be lacking in their brain in these get-up-and-go waking centers. And they have developed a medicine that may be replacing what the body is lacking. It has relatively few side effects compared to what people were using in World War II, et cetera, amphetamines, ephedrines, the methamphetamine derivative. Those are really dangerous side effects with blood pressure and heart disease.
So it's a drug that actually treats the problem as opposed to treats the symptoms of the problem.
It and as such, it replaces what should be there, and it's almost holistic, almost Mother Nature-like, yes.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about this in a moment. We're talking with Dr. Eric Daikin, a neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorders Clinic at the University of Iowa Hospitals, and we'd love to hear from you with your questions. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe, and sleep is the subject of the day. Right now, our guest is Dr. Eric Daikin. He's a neurologist, and he's also the director of the Sleep Disorders Clinic at the University of Iowa Hospitals. And we'd love to hear from you with your questions and concerns. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Larry is on the line right now from Webster City. Hello, Larry.
Good morning.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I wanted to bring up the whole topic of sleep apnea. I was diagnosed about 3 or 4 years ago. I finally got treatment, and the difference in my life has been huge, and I just think it'd be important to talk about that a little bit so other people can be aware of the symptoms and especially some of the real severe health consequences.
Oh, I like that.
Answer on the air.
All right. Thanks, Larry.
Yeah. The apnea is a hot topic, and in fact, we did research starting back in 1988, 1989, and I saw this big, heavy guy, otherwise healthy, wake up. and he had a stroke. And on his X-ray of the brain, you saw that he was bleeding. And it looked like a person who had a high blood pressure or a hypertensive hemorrhagic stroke. And we looked at the research by some of our colleagues and mentors, and we had noticed that people with apnea tended to get really high blood pressures during apneic events at night, up to 240 over 130 to 140. And sometimes their heart rates would get so slow they would stop when they would have these apneic events. Now, apnea is when you go to sleep and all your muscles relax, and in some of us, the muscles in the back of our throat over-relax. They get floppy, and when you suck in, it's like a wet straw, and you don't breathe. And again, you need sleep to keep alive. You need oxygen to keep alive, and then your body is in this battle between getting enough sleep and then waking up so that you don't have a catastrophe to your heart, your brain, or you know, life-threatening. And we've seen that people with stroke unequivocally, based on some of our work and Terry Young at the University of Wisconsin, if you don't treat a person with significant apnea, they have a higher risk of developing hypertension, stroke, which is the number three cause of death in the United States. And we've actually published the only published death in the laboratory. We observed this after an apneic event. The person essentially went into coma because there wasn't enough oxygen to the brain. Then they had a heart attack. Heart went down to absolutely nothing, and they passed from that. It was interesting how you watch somebody die ethically, morbidly fascinating. But this patient was a person who had a living will, was in an MICU study. We were looking at the prevalence of these horrific problems that we see in very sick people. And his wife had brought him in, and according to the living will, she wanted to have him go through palliative care, which was letting him go in a comfortable atmosphere without aggressive intervention with people putting needles all over his body. And she said, just keep my husband comfortable, but she wouldn't allow us to intubate him. She wouldn't allow CPAP, the therapy that you've talked about, and he passed. His passing has saved thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of lives, because as President Obama has demanded, you make sure the expensive evaluations you do in your hospital and treatments, and these are expensive evaluations and treatments, are justified. Make it science. And that's where science begins. And that's why our patients who have volunteered for research, they're the people saving the lives. The doctors are just vehicles. And this fella, I mean, almost made us cry. She come and said her last goodbyes, and she knows that her husband, even in death, has contributed to saving thousands and thousands of lives. So low oxygen in your heart and your brain. My mom's not a PhD or MD. She asked me one day what I did, and I said, I do research on sleep apnea. And she said, well, what is that? Well, it's low oxygen in your heart and your brain when you stop breathing at night. And she looked back and said, this was 20 years ago. Well, that can't be good. I mean, we have to make common sense, but we have to have it data-driven. And that's the beauty and the necessity of research and the patients that volunteer like this fellow did.
Well, and this diagnosis is getting to be more and more common, of course, since the research has advanced and you can diagnose it in more people. But what are the treatments? I know you can get a CPAP machine, which actually blows air into your mouth and nose during the night. But what else can you do?
Yeah, you know, as you mentioned too, not all the therapy you sort of have to adjust to. As you stated, blows air into your nose. I say it emits a gentle column of air that supports from the tip of the nose down to the lung beds. But it is something you have to get used to, and a lot of us don't really like the continuous positive airway pressure therapy, although for adults, it's one of the best therapies if it's given under the right circumstances and you have a good technical support 24 hours a day. There are oral devices that will, and some of us, we have little itty bitty jaws, like Marty Feldman. He was an old comedian who had a disorder called Crouzon's disease. So he had a little bitty jaw and it pushed on his throat, so he had a very small opening. And with a jaw retaining device or surgery, they advanced his jaw to open up his throat at night. So that's another kind of therapy. Weight loss. Now, I have sleep apnea, but now it's only positionally related because my doctor, Dr. Rahman, said, lose 55 pounds. And I did. But if I sleep on my back, whether I weigh 10 pounds or 220 pounds, gravity still pulls my tongue back to the back of my throat and I have apnea. So I do positional therapy. So there's this thing called a Remedy T-shirt that has little cushions on the back so I can roll over, but it won't allow me to sleep flat on my back so that in the deeper stages of sleep, I'm not at worry of having low oxygen.
That beats the system that my husband and I use where I just say, roll over. when he snores too much.
Yeah, because he's not going to listen to you.
David is on the line from Galena. Hello, David.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, Doctor. I've been diagnosed with sleep apnea a few years ago. I've tried the CPAP, and it's just very difficult to use during the night to the point where I have to pull it off. I'm 170 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 65 years old, but normally, traditionally, I guess it's people overweight that suffer from sleep apnea more than the underweight. And I think I just heard you answer one of my questions of what is on the alternative method of treatment other than CPAP.
Yeah.
I'll hang up and listen to your phone.
Well, you know, and some of us, one of my mentors, Dr. Guillemine from Stanford, he noticed in skinny people, I mean, you know, you don't have to be heavy to have obstructive sleep apnea, but skinny people with a relatively long, high arched throat, the walls are closer together, they gain a little bit of weight, they may be able to quickly suck their airways close like a wet straw. On the side of the back of your throat, the pharynx is the fancy-dancy Latin term for it, but there's lateral pharyngeal fat pads. You have some fat back there. And especially in men, if we gain more weight because of the way we lay down our fat, we gain more weight on the stomach and in the sides of the mouth. And it only takes a little to go a long way. It's like cellophane on a baby's face. You put that cellophane on a scale, doesn't weigh a thing. Put it over the child's face, it's worth 10,000 tons of concrete. And in the old days, what the doctors would do, and in some people they still can have success with it, tonsillectomy, adenoidectomy, works real good in little kiddies. They can get apnea too. And a surgery called a uvulopalatopharyngoplasty. The Latin term for all the junk in your back of your throat and that thing that hangs down in the back of your throat. They just cut out anything they can in the back of the throat that's not necessary so that you open up the airway space. Problem is, upstream from that area and downstream, you have other areas that could collapse. And as such, it's not the most successful therapy in the world, and it hurts like stink, but it's still used by good otolaryngologists in cases where other therapies fail. So we use it actively in the appropriate cases.
All right. Well, I hope that helps you out a little bit with your problem. If you'd like to give us a call, the number is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have an email now from Helen, and she says, my very active 83-year-old mother has a serious problem with sleep. She's complained for the past several years that she doesn't sleep through the night, probably gets about 4 hours of sleep per night. And when we're with her, she continually nods off but refuses to admit that she does it. We're concerned about her ability to drive to my sister's house 3.5 hours away. She's on some medications for diabetes and a blood pressure medicine. How do we proceed? And we only have about a minute left. We may have to continue this after the break, but what's your initial answer?
Well, and she needs to see a doctor. Medicine begins with history and physical examination. Got to be careful what you hear from some expert on the radio. There are over 94 specific classifications, subclassifications of sleep disorders that can make you sleepy. And one therapy may not work for all 94. In fact, some are very, very dangerous for her. So what you really need is to sit down with your doctor and look at the full history and physical examination before you can determine the disorder and then the treatment.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your question, Helen, and good luck with that. If you have a question, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, and you can tweet us at IPR Talk. We're talking with sleep doctor, Dr. Eric Dykin, and we'd love to hear from you next.
I couldn't sleep at all last night.
It's Talk of Iowa. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are talking about sleep today. My guest is Dr. Eric Dykin. He's a neurologist and the director of the Sleep Disorders Clinic at the University of Iowa Hospitals. And we would love to hear from you. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And next up, we have Pamela in Ames. Hello, Pamela.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Dr. Dykin mentioned some development of some drugs that are being used to treat narcolepsy. Wonder if he is able to share the names of those drugs and what kinds of success they've had with them.
Yeah. In fact, the drug study that we're doing right now on the head trauma is we think that people may shake your head around enough during that traumatic event. You know, the brain's like jelly. And when you shake it too much, you might cause damage to some of these get-up-and-go centers in the brain. And that's the lateral nucleus of the hypothalamus, just for the fancy-dancy term. But there's a known area where if you damage it, you can then be pathologically sleepy. Narcoleptics often develop a lack of neurons, cells in this area, and they become sleepier and sleepier, especially when they hit their teenage years. So what the doctors did many years ago and the researchers did, they looked at the chemicals that are normal waking chemicals in the system, in the central nervous system. And in a holistic-like fashion, they worked with making chemicals that mimic that action. And armodafinil and modafinil are drugs that have been approved and are out there on the market to use by FDA standards for the treatment of narcolepsy, excessive sleepiness in people who have been treated with sleep apnea on CPAP machines, and in people who are shift workers, because our bodies just aren't really made, for the most part, to work well at night, but many of us do. So it's been approved, the use of these drugs, because they've been shown in good studies to be efficacious. Not a complete cure, but can often really change the life of a sleepy person with relatively minimal side effects. But, you know, for other forms of sleepiness, if the sleepiness is due to the fact that your arthritis is so bad and you're in such pain all night that you can't get a good few hours of sleep, then maybe Motrin. That works really good for me. It used judiciously with food so you don't get an ulcer would be the best therapy for that kind of sleepiness. So there are a lot of different reasons to be sleepy. As I said before, 94 to 95 specific subcategories. I think that's 94, 95. I have to count that up again in our international classification of sleep disorder medicine. And what you really want to do, though, is make sure you have the right diagnosis of all these different potentials, and then you institute the right therapy. But in our head trauma patients, in our narcolepsy patients, when we've looked at everything else, replacing what Mother Nature may have taken away seems to work in a relatively safe fashion.
And Pamela, are you someone who has been diagnosed with narcolepsy?
Yes.
All right. So you're actually looking for a name of a medication to your doctor about?
I take modafinil.
Okay.
And I just, when he mentioned that, I wondered if there, one of the problems with modafinil is it is dreadfully expensive.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the phenomena is, I think, and I'm under the impression modafinil is about to go generic pretty soon. And won't that be nice?
Oh, yes.
But when you put billions and millions or whatever it costs to get FDA approval into a drug, when it first comes out on the market, it's just, you know, common sense business, which I'm not really in the business, but they have to reap something to replace all those monies they spent justifying a good, safe medicine.
Well, but it's been used in Britain for years.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, a lot of things, though, but, you know, like thalidomide used to be used as, you know, during in many countries. And we know that that causes a lot of real problems, you know, with delivery of children.
Yeah.
And as such, there are a lot of drugs, as you know, the TV shows, the movies always say, well, let's go to Mexico to get our steroids. So let's go to another country to get these medicines. One of the reasons our medicines are so expensive is because we're very careful about the side effects. Now, that's, there's a lot of other reasons they're expensive. But I think that's a phenomena of a new medicine. And I'm under the impression, and I was looking at this morning, that modafinil may be going generic pretty soon.
All right. Well, and Pamela, yeah. I hope that's true for your sake.
Yeah. Well, for a lot of people, I mean, I have very good insurance, but, I mean, we're talking hundreds of dollars for a month's treatment.
Yeah, what is that, $5, $6 a pill?
I have outstanding insurance, and I get mine, I think the last 3 months' supply was $250.
Yeah.
I asked the pharmacist once when I picked it up just, out of idle curiosity, I said, if I had no insurance and came in here with this prescription, what would it cost me? And for a month, we were talking roughly $600.
Wow.
Yep. Lots of money. And we're all empathetic to that. And I think a lot of the doctors have been working, you know, I know a lot of our colleagues out there with samples and this and that, trying to get everybody by. But hopefully, when this stuff goes generic, and I'm under the impression that they're thinking about taking that armodafinil and tried to sell it at a relatively low cost so they can continue, you know, running their drug-related businesses. But I'm not sure about that. But I'm sure empathetic about medicines. When the new ones come out, they're great. But the double-edged sword is they're often awful expensive until they go generic.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call, Pamela. Shauna Ray is up next in Johnston. Hello, Shauna Ray.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Idiopathic hypersomnia. It's been suggested that I get tested for it, so I'm not talking like I have this diagnosis yet by any means. But I have I regularly sleep 8 to 10 hours a night. I fall asleep within 2 to 3 minutes of laying down. I fall asleep at movies all the time. My problem is that I need to be at work by 8 a.m. and have an incredibly hard time with it. And I nap for long periods. And when I read about it, the double-edged sword of Google, it sounds like this is kind of a catch-all diagnosis for a lot of different sleep problems that don't fit under other categories. And I just get nervous thinking about going on a medication for something like that, if that were even to be the case. And I know I'm future-tripping a little bit, but do you have any words about that? I did hear that there's 90 different things, so maybe it's a little bit generic. But
Well, you know, and that's the interesting thing. Sometimes we can we tend to call a sleepiness due to a reason we haven't really defined yet. We create a garbage term for it. But idiopathic hypersomnolence is actually, if that's what you truly have, a very specific disorder. Mm-hmm. And many of our patients will sleep less than 10 to 15 hours, and some will sleep even more than 10 mm-hmm. to 15 hours. So there's a long type and there's a short type. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to treat, but oftentimes people have been using the modafinils and the armodafinils for that judiciously, and then trying to make sure that you get as much solidified sleep as you can. The other thing is many of us can be just long sleepers. Have you ever tried to sleep over 10 hours per night, every night, 7 days, a month, like on a vacation, you know, just consistently do that? And would have you know, if you did do that, did you notice that you felt any better?
All I can say is I never feel very rested when I wake up in the morning, mm-hmm. even if I sleep over 10 hours. But no, to answer your question specifically, I've not done it for a month. And there's just this kind of groggy period every day when I wake up.
Well, it is interesting. It's a bell-shaped curve. Some people are absolutely normal, can sleep 4 to 5 hours every night. That's less than 5% of us. Some people, less than 5% of us, need maybe 10, 16 hours of sleep a night. And as you've implied, we have to function in this Western industrial society. How can you hold down a job if you're sleeping 16 hours a night?
Certainly.
And what I would think I would do, if I were you, talk to your local doctor. That's the backbone of medicine in the United States. And during a vacation, have a wonderful vacation. Do a two-week vacation. Try to sleep 10-plus hours every night at a routine bedtime awakening time so you don't feel pressured. Do it for that period of time. See if you feel better. It could be that you're just a long sleeper, and that's not necessarily fair either. But before you start jumping into medicines, maybe give that a little trial. And if you do see improvement, then that's beautiful. That gives the patient control over their medical issues. Mm-hmm. And as a patient myself, I find that's some solace.
How do you test for idiopathic hypersomnia?
What we do is make sure the patient has had their maximum amount of sleep, what they find ideal, with a routine bedtime and awakening time for about a two-week period before coming into the laboratory. Then what we do is we let them go to bed anytime they routinely go to bed. And then we let them sleep as long as possible. And some of the patients with idiopathic hypersomnolence will sleep 15 hours with pretty good sleep efficiency, normal sleep staging, all the brainwave things, but they just sleep long as can be. And when they wake up, we often do a maintenance of wakefulness test or a multiple sleep latency test. We give them a series of naps throughout the day, separated by about 2-hour intervals. And compared to Sanders, we see how fast they fall asleep. And if they really are sleeping that long and they've kept that diary, that would be the best way. And then, you, as she has implied, you rule out everything else. You know, there are people who could have been hit in the head, brain injury. There are people who could have early Alzheimer's disease. That can often be associated with sleepiness. And any of those other 90-some differential diagnoses that we talked about. Rule those out and then maybe do the test.
All right. Well, Shauna Ray, thank you so much for your call and good luck.
Yeah, good luck.
Definitely. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you have questions today for Dr. Eric Daikin about sleep, Ellen is on the line now from Ames. Hello, Ellen.
Yes.
What would you like to talk about?
I am looking for some advice for my husband who is not getting enough sleep. He has MS. He takes an injectable called Rebif for that. He has been also trying to find an antidepressant that is going to work for him. He's been off and on them over the years. He's very sensitive to them. He also has some anxiety issues. He takes Xanax for that. But he is having trouble finding something to help him stay asleep. They've tried Ambien. They're trying amitriptyline right now. And he will get to sleep, but then he wakes up at like 1 or 2 in the morning. He's lucky to get maybe 5 hours of sleep and, of course, is having trouble functioning at his job.
Well, you know, that's again, it's a big problem. Sometimes a disorder in itself, multiple sclerosis can affect multiple areas of the brain. Also, when you have multiple sclerosis, you may not necessarily be happy about having a chronic disease that you're going to have to live with the rest of your life. There's the psychological element of being anxious, depressed, and not happy with the progressive nature of the disorder itself. As you mentioned, there's medicines involved with this. And as men get older and we have more health-related problems, the anxiety we have with that often interferes with our sleep. As we said, 90-some different things just in one single book that could be associated with this. But, you know, good sleep hygiene, trying to go to bed at a specific time every night, an awakening routinely at a specific time every morning, which is a little easier said than done. And some of the medicines that you've suggested, the Ambien, the Zolpidems, some of these drugs actually mimic what we call gamma-aminobutyric acid, which is a chemical in the brain that may help you get to sleep. And if you do have a degenerative process where the brain may be hit and hurt over and over and over, trying to replace what the brain may be missing seems more holistic to me. But if it doesn't work, maybe you should try other GABAergic-like medications with everything else, trying to keep good sleep hygiene, making sure you don't have sleep apnea. Men just tend to get it. Normal men can have sleep apnea. Rule out everything else out and then try some of the more holistic medicines. I know Esopiclone, the Sonatas, the Ambien, the Zolpidems. I mean, you can reel off a lot of names that are now out there that are GABAergic. That may have little side effect but more efficaciousness. But one thing you have to remember, life is tough. A lot of us will have a good day of being well rested and have a sleepy day. I'm sort of sleepy today because I work at night when I'm on call for the sleep laboratory. But I know this too will pass. But what we want to make sure, though, is that we do things in a holistic, stepwise fashion, work with the sleep hygiene, rule out the other dangerous things like apnea, et cetera, and then understand cure. I'm not sure what cure is. In 150 years, we'll probably all be dust, but that there is some improvement that gives you frank improvement of your quality of life and can make you happy. So I wouldn't go for cure because I don't know what that means, but if you find a doc who can help you with some of these newer medicines that can improve things just a little bit, well, I'd buy that.
Does that help you out, Ellen?
Yes, it does.
All right.
All righty.
Right now, nothing's working.
Well, good luck. Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. We still have time for a few more calls, 866-780-9100. We have an email from Hannah who says that she was wondering what causes talking in your sleep. She says she's a student at the University of Iowa, been known to talk in my sleep, but I don't know very much about it.
Yeah. Well, talking in sleep, you know, the fancy Latin word, I guess, is the somniloquy. Normal people talking to sleep. And there's a lot of different things that can cause that. Now, usually dream sleep, which is called rapid eye movement sleep, is where we often will talk out of because we have a stimulation in dreaming sleep of the part of the brain that sees, the part of the brain that hears, and an overstimulation to the point of exhaustion of part of the brain that moves. So intrinsic to all dream is a sort of a movement, visual, auditory, even in some blind people. So you have this kind of a dream and you want to respond to what you're dreaming to, and it's not unusual people will talk during REM sleep. It's also not unusual to get somebody who is so drowsy. They've been up all night at the wedding reception and they're sitting on the couch. They're in and out of wakefulness and they'll sort of talk to you and you know they're not quite there. So that's sort of an ambulatory kind of sleep-wake problem, you know, just being so drowsy you're just not quite with us with automatic-like behavior. So it's a normal thing. We all do it from time to time. Many of us may say, well, I've never done that, but how would you know because you're asleep when you're doing that? But if you're just lucky or unlucky enough to be around a spouse or a neighbor or a bed partner, it's not unusual to hear talking from time to time.
My daughter talks in her sleep, which I really appreciate because when she was very young, she's always been very verbal. So even when she was a year and a half old, she'd wake up from a nightmare or something, but she would talk in her sleep before she woke up. And so I would know what it was about. And it was always reassuring because they weren't that scary.
Yeah. And that scary is relative to the beholder.
Right. She didn't want our dog to take away a flower. So it was frightening to her, but I felt very reassured as a mother that was the scariest thing her mind could come up with. So maybe it's a good tool at least for parents. The number to call is 866-780-9100. We have Lucas on the line in Manchester. Hello, Lucas.
Hi. I was wondering what the importance of a regular sleep schedule is for people just without any sleep disorders.
Well, I think it's Jerome Siegel at the University UCLA. He had shown that, you need around 7 to 9 hours, most of us, on the bell-shaped curve to be healthy. There is something restorative, if you will, about sleep. We know in animal studies that if you sleep deprive an animal for 16 to 20 some days, they die. We know that if you sleep more than this 7 to 9 on a routine basis, a pathology is implied. If you sleep less because you're burning the candle at both ends, that's a pathology in and of itself. And if you don't get what your body considers, again, it's a broad bell-shaped curve, that 5 to 10 hours of sleep, then there have been associated higher morbidities, you tend to be sicker, and mortalities. You tend to live less long. And the simplistic thing is, and you can taste it, don't let someone sleep for 3 days. We consider that torture. How horrific. Your body knows it needs to sleep, and in a holistic fashion, you need to follow it. And the science backs up what seems to be common sense. There's something restorative, and if you don't get it routinely, it's probably like smoking cigarettes too much, drinking too much, and eating high fatty foods too much. It has tended to be associated with more illnesses, depression, gastrointestinal problems, and earlier death.
And do we cope with that better when we're younger than we do as we age? Does it get more important to have a good sleep pattern as you get into your 30s and 40s and beyond?
Yeah, and see what we do to our kids. We try to do the best things for them, but as we talked about, really the time for early school isn't the time that fits them the best. It's the time that fits the family the best so we can get them off and we then get to work. But kids tend to adapt very well, and when you hear about the delayed phase syndrome, a lot of parents will say, my kids do just fine, and their kids probably do because they have some what we call circadian strength. They have more cells in their biologic clock, and they can run faster, jump higher, talk faster, and sleep better than us. But when you start getting older, insomnia is intrinsic to getting over the age of 50, 60, 70, and a lot of times you need to assist Mother Nature with some of the medicines and treatments we've talked about.
All right. We have time to fit in a final call. This is John on the line from Iowa City. Hello, John.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have an 8-year-old boy with ADD and with a mild case of Tourette's, and he's taking Focalin and Strattera. And then in the evening, as he comes down off of those ADD meds, it's just really hard for him to get to sleep. So we've been working with a psychiatrist, and we've been giving him Clonidine at night, which makes him really sleepy.
Mm-hmm.
And my concern is I don't want his body to lose its natural ability to fall asleep. And should he mature out of these conditions, my concern is that he's still going to need some medication to to fall asleep as he gets older. Is my concern founded?
Well, you know, it's always good to be concerned and to ask for second opinion and to question things. But as you've implied, as we get older, we can change. And what I sort of like about a lot of the medications and what I like to do when someone has excessive sleepiness, that may be a bit intermittent or excessive insomnia, give the patient enough medicines for about a week worse and tell them, use it only when you need it. And that gives the patient power. So if you have a great sleep on one night, if things look fine, don't use the medicine. But you can always know that if you're starting to have a real crummy night, you have that in your back pocket. And I honestly believe if you did a comparative study that the people would sleep much better and use less medication if they had that kind of control to decide when or when they wouldn't use the medicine. And I think as you've implied, as your child gets older, you might test a night. Talk to him. If he looks good, even give him a little bit of control. Say, do you feel you need this or not tonight? There are a lot of medicines we can use to sedate. A lot of these studies, you know, are not ethically done on kids. So an awful lot of treating kids with sleeping and awake problems are what we say open label sort of art of medicine. And as such, I would put it in my back pocket, talk to the doctor very carefully, because your doctor knows a lot more about your child than I do. But see if some of that might be, a drug holiday when you go out to the beach and things like that. But it is a problem, and as such, we do have an expert at the University of Iowa who deals with sleep problems and insomnia, and that's my wife. And if things get out of hand, that's what God made a second opinion for.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your call, John. Thank you to everybody who called in today. We've been talking with Dr. Eric Dykin. He's a neurologist and the director of the Sleep Disorders Clinic at the University of Iowa Hospitals. And this is Talk of Iowa. Thank you so much, Dr. Dykin.
Thank you for having me.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Rosalind Sixby. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow, it's Politics Day on the Talk of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm home.